Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp, number 99, across the line. Let's say hi to all our folks out and about. We've got Mikey from Chicagoland.
Hey, how's it going?
We've got Thomas Kiernek from Slovakia.
Hello, everyone.
And again, you got me from Texas. Boring old Texas. Let's jump right in. We have a new patron this week. It's Carlin Ray. And I love, again, another solid patron. Guy jumps in and is immediately firing from the hip. All kinds of good stuff coming out of this dude. He's like, I'm not sure where he is. No, I do know where he is. He's like in Washington State, I think. And he's like an ex-sprinkler guy. And so he brings a lot of different disciplines into the Slack. He's a bit of an electronics hacker. It looks like he's kind of piecing stuff together into random enclosures. It's pretty cool. And if you want to become a patron, you go to patreon.com/thebrotherswisp, throw us a couple of bones, and you get access to our patron-only Slack, which is where all the good stuff is. That's where you get direct access to people like Mikey. So if you want to get into a flame war, you can. Or Thomas, so that you can get overburdened with information about how you're doing things wrong and you could do it better.
Now you've just made everyone scared of me.
Maybe they should be. Do you ever think
of that? Well, I mean, you know, your son's better than a flame war with me.
Well, I mean, everybody likes to get to a fight they know they can win, Mikey, so, you know.
Greg's just giving us all kinds of positive PR today.
I'm your guys' biggest cheerleader. There you go. All right. So, first things first, Nick Arellano got married on Thursday. So, you guys that know him, drop him a line, say congratulations, all that good stuff. And those that have had bad experiences, give him your words of warning, I guess, if that's a thing for people. Monumental. Sooner or later, we're going to hear the same from Thomas.
One day.
Let's see. I got a quote of the week, which I liked. John Osmond said, "He doesn't pay me enough to shut up," which I thought was really fun way of looking at something. He was giving his opinion to somebody who he was doing work for, and he's not paying me enough to shut up. So I'm curious. It's like, how much does someone have to pay you for you to shut up? I guess I kind of shut up at my hashtag day jobs. I guess maybe they pay me to be quiet. I don't know. You guys certainly don't pay me enough to shut up, though. I thought that was pretty brilliant.
I should probably get my payments then.
No, for sure. Let's see. Slack. I asked the Slack what you guys like for 4-port SFP Plus interfaces just for a server. Not necessarily MikroTik related, but I guess it would work well with a MikroTik as well. But you guys said the Intel, what is it, X710-DA4 was a good one. And my guy that's building up a server has purchased one, and I guess we'll give it a go and see how it do. I'm sure most of these, I mean, most Intel NICs are pretty much the same nowadays, right? Like the SFP Plus ones. You guys have any experience with that?
I haven't used the 710, but I've used quite a few of the 510 or 520s. It's a dual port. And they work. One annoying thing is that I think they have an Intel SFP lock. So you have to make sure that you get your optics coded for Intel. Or use DAX.
Gotcha. Yeah, I recommended that he get the branded, or not necessarily branded, but the coded Intel SFPs just to make sure. And like, if you're shopping it, I mean, a lot of people pick up their kit off of Amazon, or if you're going to fiber store, I mean, it's the same NIC as everything else, just coded a little bit differently, right?
Yeah.
Which I still don't understand the vendor lock-in when it's so easy for people to buy third-party NICs that are coded for anything else. Why bother?
It's the certification, right? If you want to be 100% official and on all of the hardware compatibility lists, and you have to have that official certification and support, then you just have to shell out the money.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. I mean, I guess that makes sense, right? I mean, that's like Apple's approach, right, to their ecosystem. It's like, we make all of the hardware. You have to buy all of our stuff if you want it to be technically covered. And I mean, it totally makes sense, right? So it's a known quantity.
Screw everybody.
I'm looking for silver linings here. I can understand why they do it. Not just make a lot more money, which, you know, is another rationale for doing such things.
To make fanboys feel better about themselves?
I don't know. I like how I look with a MikroTik. I don't think I've ever actually put a MikroTik optic in a MikroTik. I always use the Cisco coded stuff, and it works just fine. Let's see. Thomas, somebody was asking about, I think it was Jeremy in Perth, was asking about, he's going to be doing some broadband test projects, so he's got to put some nodes out there. I guess that's a governmental regulation is what he was saying. You have to be able to prove your speeds, and so he wanted to have a small device that could do up to a gig. And I think, Thomas, you recommended the Pi 4s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you done such projects? I think Justin Miller was talking about using Pi 4s with NetXMS to actually do bandwidth tests and graph them, right?
So I've done quite a few things in the past on this front, both in performance testing of various equipment as well as actual like production deploy of speed test nodes around large networks. And this used to be really hard before the Pi 4, because Pi 2 and Pi 3, sadly, they had gigabit NICs, but they were connected over USB 2 interface. So really, from a Pi 2 or a Pi 3, the best you could get is about 200 megs due to the USB 2 Ethernet interface. So up to those 200 megs, Pi 2 and Pi 3 were great for like these little, you know, out in the wild deployments and like multiple nodes around the network where you have, where you do speed testing from various sources to various destinations. But when you needed more than that, in the past, that used to be hard, because there was really no like small little SBC, single board computer device, talking about like 5 years ago. This was before even the Intel Knox came around, right? Knox, the NUCs. So before those, it was hard. And when the Knox came out, those are still quite expensive if you need like, you know, 50 of them to be scattered around the network in various conditions where they break due to temperature or, you know, just get, you know, destroyed by environment. But now with the Pi 4, it's an amazing little device that can easily do a gigabit over iPerf. And the CPU is powerful enough, the Ethernet is actually on a PCI Express bus, so it will do full native gigabit, and it's just like, it simplified projects like these so much. It's, yeah, I definitely recommend it for anybody looking for little, fully functional Linux nodes to scatter around various places and do various things like performance monitoring with. It's a great tool.
I can't really remember, what is a Pi 4 retail for?
It depends. There are multiple versions. There is 1, 2, and 4 gig RAM version. And the cheapest one, the 1 gig RAM, is $35.
Not bad at all.
Of course, you have to get a cooler for it, because the Pi 4 runs a little bit hot, so you have to get a heatsink. You need some case, you need some power supply, and then an SD card to run it off. But, I mean, altogether, it's like $60-$65.
Yeah, that's not bad at all. Especially if you've got governmental regulations and stuff like that. You know what popped in my head was, I was thinking about this. If you were, say you're a WISP and you've got these scattered throughout your networks and you want to do periodic tests. I remember he was saying that, you know, they can't just do a test at 3 a.m. They actually have to do it, you know, like at peak time, so they can give real reporting of what throughput could theoretically look like at a peak time for them, which I think is brilliant, right? Truth in advertising sort of thing there. But I was thinking, say you're running it on a network that's already got a decent bit of traffic, and you run this thing and you saturate the link. I mean, that seems like a bad idea, right? So if you completely saturate one of your backhauls, you're going to start getting packet loss. So
this adds a lot of complexity, right? Because now you have to do QoS, even on link layer, right? For this to not affect your customers. So likely, what you would do in this case, you would set up QoS properly and basically give the test the lowest priority possible. So you would just use it to saturate the link, but not to affect other traffic, and then you would measure actually the link itself rather than what the speed test is showing you to be able to see full capacity of the link. But then again, who knows what the regulations, you know, are requiring.
Right.
Because if the regulations are requiring to show you like single TCP stream throughput at a given time, then you will want that single TCP throughput to be the highest, which means it will affect other customers. Also, you know, is there some mandatory testing software that you have to use that's out of your control? Maybe this is a complicated topic with many variables.
Yeah, so and thinking about it too, like it seems like there's two options. One is just to see from this node back to, I guess, wherever I'm testing from. What's the maximum throughput I could get, right? So totally saturate the link. Or conversely, you could say, all right, I'm going to set the theoretical maximum for this Pi 4 to be what my highest user package is, right? So say I've got, you know, 75 megabits is my highest user package. Well, I will only allow it to go up to that, right? So that you're simulating a customer experience. So technically, it wouldn't saturate your entire backhaul. And so, you know, I guess that would be a little bit truer test, right? Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. Hopefully one more customer on the network doesn't completely saturate the link, right? So that would be, I guess, more emulating the customer experience. So maybe that's what they have to do. I don't know. He didn't really give details on that, or if he did, I didn't read it close enough. But it seems like that would actually be for some kind of compliance thing, a good reason. But it seems like a lot of WISPs would want to know, what's the periodically, what's the theoretical maximum throughput I can get across a backhaul, you know, at least for capacity planning, you know, like how many customers can I hang off of XYZ tower, you know, how much bandwidth can my links really support across this? Not just what's on the box that my radio came in, but what can I actually get through this link?
So when I was doing this in the past, it was always at the time where it would influence customers the least. So this would be automated. One project I did was automated nightly performance testing across the network. But this was, you know, at really, I think it was like at 3:30 a.m. Yeah. Because, you know, from their graphs, that was the least utilized time of the network. And yeah, it would just run for, I think we were doing 30-second bursts across the network, collecting the results and reporting, graphing them. This was all using iPerf, Raspberries, and NetXMS, of course. So all the results were aggregated into NetXMS and graphed in NetXMS, and then there were dashboards and reports made out of this, of course, also in NetXMS. But this is very different from, yeah, doing it during prime time. You know, that's a very different consideration. Yeah.
Seems like in prime time, you wouldn't want to try and test your entire link. Maybe the individual customer experience would be kind of the way to go with that.
I mean, that can be hard as well, right? Because if you have some business customers, which usually for business customers, you will have very different links than for residential customers, right? Yeah. And even it's quite usual, right, to have like one-off business customers that have super high speeds compared to others. So I think a lot of this depends on what the regulatory body requires of you, you know, because if you have that one customer which has a 200 megabit link, which is on a dedicated point-to-point, you know, wireless connection, and how will you test if that one is performing as it should, if you should be testing, you know, during prime time and the customer is actually utilizing that link and that link is at capacity because it's a link dedicated to that customer, then, you know.
For sure. A lot of variables, a lot of moving pieces there.
Yet, so I was just looking at what the FCC requires for CAF 2 phase 2 projects, which are just being built now. For latency, we require a minimum of one discrete test per minute for each of the testing hours. And I forget where they defined the testing hours, but I believe it was focused on prime time usage.
Well, latency is an easy test.
And then for speed, we require a minimum of one download test and one upload test per testing hour at each subscriber test location. So
from each tower, I guess?
No, each subscriber. So each subscriber, you need to do a speed test once an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. That's a lot of moving
honestly,
pieces.
I would say that's even stupid.
They've had a lot of people that take government money for, building on a project and then say, oh, yeah, it performs.
Yeah.
It's a 100 meg service and there's nothing to verify it or and the test locations are off net because people will, you can get 100 megs to the test server on my network,
right.
but I have bad peering or I've got, I don't have big enough pipe to the world. I only have a 200 meg connection and I'm selling 100 meg internet, I get where they're just, trying to cut down on people doing fraud and really, if you're getting a whole big pile of government money, there's no reason why you can't.
I am not saying, don't verify if people are doing the right things, but this is mathematical. You can verify, an average customer uses this much bandwidth this many percent of the time and I have, this much available throughput on my uplinks and blah, blah, blah. This should come from mathematics, from submitting statistics about your client base, the packages you are selling, and your upstream connections, right? You can easily calculate all of this mathematically. Of course, that's just theory. So you should still do testing. Yeah, sure, 100%, but I don't think it should be like once an hour, do a ridiculous amount of data, 50 megs, which realistically, if you're providing a 100 megabit connection, 50 megabytes is barely enough to ramp up the TCP window to actually test if that speed is good enough. And now, if you do the math on this, I need 100 megabytes of data transferred to test a 100 megabit connection. That's 8 seconds, right? As I said, barely enough to ramp up the TCP window. So if I have 1,000 customers and I'm testing each customer once an hour and going off that with this, how much just useless data and load am I putting on my network? It doesn't make sense in that way at all.
Yeah.
You're doing what, 12 customers every minute? Something like that? With 1,000?
Yeah. And let's just say 100 megs, right? So that's, 1.2 gigs every minute. That's crazy.
Yeah. That would just be, especially if it actually has to go through your upstreams, through your peers. That's just, that kind of throws 95th percentile billing out the window because your circuits are constantly getting jammed. So,
that sucks. Like I said before, this is, it's really stupid.
I believe, so then this, for this FCC testing, it's being done via Sam Knows, and I believe Sam Knows does have a relationship with Cloudflare. It doesn't appear to be exclusive. I was working on trying to get them, to do stuff at our IXs, but in terms of your 95th percentile, you just connect to an exchange where Cloudflare is, assuming that's an approved test location. And, away you go. You don't have to worry about 95th percentile because transport and IXs are rarely priced that way. Transit is, for sure.
Still, is it realistic results then if you are dedicating a link and choosing preferential pathing for the tests?
Well, I believe it would be on an exchange. So then if you're on an exchange, you're there, you would also have then, good capacity to Google and Akamai and Netflix and, Amazon and so on and so on and so on. And, obviously they can't guarantee good performance to everywhere, but I think their intention is, where is the bulk of the consumer traffic going, to these, big content sources. And then,
But still, we've just calculated that for 1,000 customers, it's 1.2 gigs of traffic, pretty much constant. That's ridiculous.
Doesn't seem super sustainable as you grow, right? Say your number gets up to 10,000 subscribers. That's going to get hairy pretty quick.
Now all that said, there could be more things in here that I have, because I just pulled up the document as we were talking about it, and it is a 38-page PDF.
How fun.
So there's a lot of stuff in there, and we very well could be missing big piles of stuff.
All right. Well, if anybody's got any information, I'm sure they will share it with us. Share their thoughts, their wisdom. Let's keep boogieing on down. So something that I saw in the Slack roll by was Thrift. Somebody had asked about InnoMicroTik disabling the route cache, and Thrift says it causes more problems than it solves. He also said that version 7 has no route cache in the kernel. So I'm not 100% sure why somebody would want to disable the route cache. I think the route cache is like the fib, right, as opposed to the routing table. So you take the routing table, you compile it, put it into the fib for faster lookups. So what if you make a change in the rib and it's not propagating quick enough to the route cache? Is that why you would want to disable it in a MicroTik? So
I think this is a little bit different, and I am not 100% sure off the top of my head, but I think how route cache works is that every time there is a routing decision, so there is a lookup in the actual routing table, it is cached based on the source destination hash. So the source and the destination are hashed, the outgoing interface is looked up in the routing table, and that is cached. This, for example, what this does is when you have ECMP equal cost multipaths, it guarantees that a single source destination pair will always take the same route out of the ECMP. MicroTik doesn't do per packet load balancing on ECMP. It's on a per source destination pair. And this is what the route cache does, right? It fills up. The more communication goes through the router, the more source destination pairs get hashed, and the routing decision gets cached. Ah. This is what the routing cache is. So disabling that, you would force a lookup to the routing table for every single packet. Whereas if you keep it enabled, you just hash source destination, lookup in memory, in that hash. It's a much simpler because now you are just looking up data in a map, key value pair in hashes. And that's much faster than going to the entire routing table and looking up, in a routing table potentially if you've got full BGP peer, half a million or 600k routes.
Hmm. Can you imagine a situation where you'd want to disable it?
I have never had to, and I don't know any use cases where you want that. So
okay.
For me personally, no.
Whoever it was that was talking about it, I don't think elaborated on why they wanted to do that. It was just very curious to me that somebody was talking about disabling, so I thought I'd bring it up and see. I'm sure there's some crazy use case, maybe not crazy, but maybe there's some edge use case where it makes sense. I just don't know what it is. Mm. So speaking of MicroTiks, last week...
Real quick, I found I was going through that PDF more, and so it looks like it's not as crazy as we thought. The number of test locations that they require, I was mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
It is between 5 and 50 the grant supported locations per service tier per state. So if you had,
much more reasonable,
you know, a 100 meg tier and a gig tier in one state, you know, between 10 and 100 customers, depending on how big you were. But it's about, you know, but it's focused on about 10%.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's much more reasonable.
Yeah, that seems scalable. So, let's see, catch it back up. There's a customer that owns a fiber network, and they're doing switching instead of, like, optical muxing on this fiber network, which is fine. They're using some really expensive kit, and I stuck a MikroTik on there to be the interface for their management network to the rest of the world. And I got a call from them saying, hey, 2 days ago, the router locked up for some reason, and we had to reboot it, and it got going again. And then yesterday it locked up, and we rebooted it, and it doesn't seem to be working anymore. Can you go take a look at it? So I went up there late in the day, which is okay, because I stopped by the Mexican bakery that's near the data center, and I picked up some empanadas and some tacos. Man, they are like the filthiest tacos. It's so delicious. Anyway, I digress. So I got in there, and I plugged in the MikroTik, and I was trying to do MAC Telnet to it, and it wasn't showing up at all. I switched ports, and I could actually see it, but it wouldn't let me connect. So I had pre-configured a replacement, so I just slapped it in. There was like a half AC squared. So I slapped that in there, turned it on, plugged my laptop in, exact same thing. I was like, what the hell's going on? So I unplug all the ports, and it works just fine. I'm in it. Then I plug in the server's ports. You know, they had a server in there for management. Works just fine. I plug in the kind of the WAN port. It's got two trunk ports, one to their management subnet, one, you know, it's like a VLAN to their management subnet, and then one that's their internet connection coming on over another VLAN. And the instant I plug that in, I lose all access to the MikroTik. I unplug that port, it comes back. So I just left it in for about 5 minutes, and then unplugged it, connected back in, and sure enough, the MikroTik told me that there was excessive broadcast multicast traffic, probably a loop. So I thought that was pretty killer. It was obviously overwhelming because, I mean, what is it? It's got like four processors on that thing, or right, or like dual hyper-threaded or something like that. So, and it's like 750 megahertz. So it's a decent little router. And it was obviously overloading all the CPUs, which is why I couldn't connect to it. I mean, it wouldn't even hand me an IP via DHCP while it was doing this thing. But it's still, as soon as I, you know, killed the port that actually had the loop on it, you know, it was still up and available, and I could look at the log, which I thought was pretty cool. It seems like in the past, like in the long, long ago with MikroTik stuff, they would just crash, you know, when a situation like this would arise. And I guess there's some protection mechanisms in them now. So I know, like, too, if you BGP peer with a MikroTik and it's got some kind of percentage of RAM that it must maintain. So the route table will load up to a point till it hits that, you know, small amount of RAM left over, and then it'll just stop loading. So that, I guess, the router doesn't completely tip over. And I guess they're doing some throttling on the CPU as well, so that it just doesn't completely crash, which I think is awesome. So it at least gave me some insight, even though it was a lower powered MikroTik and it couldn't withstand the flavor of that magnitude. It still was there enough to show me some stuff in the logs, and then I could turn that over to the customer, because I didn't manage the rest of their network, just kind of a little bit there at the edge. And they were able to turn on Spanning Tree and rectify the issue, which was really nice. I just thought that was, awesome, right? It was unresponsive. I couldn't actually connect to it, but it didn't completely die. So I thought that was pretty baller.
It Does MikroTik have hardware-based broadcast multicast mitigation, you know, storm control?
I think, what, like the CRSs have storm control. I know that. They do that in hardware. So, like, the CRS300s have hardware storm control. I don't guess anything else can.
Because I would assume that would mitigate that issue if in hardware it was, you know, limiting that to a reasonable rate, that then the OS wouldn't have an issue with it, I assume.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I don't guess you could do that with anything else, because it's not going to do it in hardware, so it's just going to all do it in CPU or attempt to. And it was just too many packets coming at the board to be able to do anything. So, eh.
I think you could handle it, this theoretically, through bridge filters as well, right? If bridge filters dropped, like, you know, you can allow a certain packet rate through a filter. So you could do a bridge filter, and I don't mean use IP firewall for a bridge, I just mean a bridge filter.
Right.
And you could limit the packet rate based on the broadcast MAC address to a certain point. Maybe. Of course, it depends on what was actually loading the CPU up so much. If it was forwarding of those broadcast frames, or if it was actually some logic, you know, on a higher layer, like actual application logic inside of the MicroTik that had to process those packets, and then it was dying because of that. So it depends, but maybe bridge filters with packet rate filtering could protect you from that, but it just depends.
Hmm. But the simple answer is put on some layer 2 loop protection and not have to worry about this sort of thing.
Yeah, it seems like this is the second podcast in a row where we have to tell people to use STP.
Yeah, because this really, I mean, this thing was really just acting as a router on those VLAN interfaces, and it was just getting so many packets per second, it just couldn't handle it. It was pretty bananas. So, Thomas, somebody was asking about FiberStore switches, and whenever you're asking about a variety of hardware, you have so much experience with so many vendors at this point due to Unimus, the amazing Unimus.net product that you sell, that you had the insight of pretty much every switch that FiberStore sells has a different firmware, different CLI interface, different syntax used for different commands. So I guess no configuration consistency.
Yeah, and it's not just that. Some of the switches that FiberStore sells are marketed as GCOM. So if you do like show version, it will tell you GCOM switch and then the model. Some are marketed and in show version they show you FiberStore, but they are completely different CLIs. There is documentation is completely else, completely different for every single model family. There is just no consistency, and you can really see that they are just cheap OEM switches with OEM provided software that FiberStore is really just reselling. They're not developing any of those NOSs, right. Network operating systems running on those switches, right? They receive a reference OS and they just sell it with the reference OS.
Gotcha.
And apparently not even modifying the reference OS to include their name all the time.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, for Unimus, right, we support quite a few of those FiberStore switch lines, but it's like anytime we receive a ticket of, you know, a FiberStore switch is not working, I just forward it directly to a developer with a new driver, FiberStore, and model, because I know right away it's just, it's not that it doesn't work, it's just that the syntax and the CLI is so different on every single one, and the documentation is different and everything else, and... But I mean, you get what you pay for, right? So,
gotcha. I wonder if
there is a reason why all of these FiberStore switches are so cheap.
Well, I think at least a chunk of those FiberStore switches are designed so that you can load in another operating system on them, right?
Yeah, some of them, right?
Right, not all of them.
Some of them are white box-ish switches. I don't want to say they are white box switches because that's, you know, a different thing, but some of them are open enough in a way that, yeah, you can load various different reference OSs, and I mean, in the end, just like any other switch, they use the same chipsets, right? They use the same ASICs, so it's not that, you know, there is not 1,000 different switch chips and ASICs you can use in the world today. There is honestly just a few manufacturers manufacturing a few different switch lines, which all the Linux drivers are the same for. I mean, within, of course, the ASIC and the switch lines.
Yeah.
So,
Have you guys put in a Unimus driver for Cumulus?
Yes.
Gotcha. Have you run into it a lot?
Actually, we had support for Cumulus 2 just about from beginning of Unimus, and then some customers ask even for Cumulus 3, so we have support for 2 and 3 because they have a bit of a different way of interacting with them. So yeah, it actually came from customer requests.
Very nice. And Cumulus is a network operating system, the kind that you can load on, say, some of these fiber store switches, not all of them, but some of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically just a Linux OS tailored or, you know, packaged for networking operations, right? So you get packages pre-installed there for most of your normal OS or NOS, you know, network operating system required things. But yeah, it's just a Linux system like any other.
Very nice. I've never touched it, but I assume it's probably got some market share due to the white box stuff that's starting to become more and more available.
Also, it's support, right? When it's a Linux network operating system, but it actually comes with training, support, and documentation directly from Cumulus, and that's usually a big reason why people buy it.
Nice. So let's see. Carl, go ahead.
I'll say it as a tangent off of the Cumulus comment. Have either of you looked at this Arcus company? I think I posted it in Slack, maybe. It's something that I saw from Kevin Myers posted, I think it was on Facebook, maybe. It runs on Oni white box switches. They built everything from the ground up. And they support separating the control plane from the forwarding plane such that you run the heavy stuff on a physical box in, you know, on a cloud server somewhere, on a VM on your network to do all the, you know, BGP heavy lifting and things like that, and then they just push it from there into whatever the switch supports.
I mean, it's kind of like the open flow model, right? Where you've got a controller that's pushing out routing decisions to edge devices.
OpenFlow in itself is a debate we could probably talk for hours on, but it's SDN. It's SDN design.
Which is a can of worms, just saying SDN, because some people will think, oh, well, that's what I use to automatically bring up my IPsec tunnels on the edge of my network to all of my things, right? It's like everybody's got kind of a, or I guess more people will call that SD-WAN, right?
I think there's SD, whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
Kevin was saying that that their dev team was claiming that they could load 30 million routes in 40 seconds into, it seems like, generic switches. So that's interesting how that happens. Does MPLS, segment routing, whatever BGP LSVR is, I don't even know what that is, but apparently it does it. So it sounds like the new hot stuff, if it actually does anything, you know, becomes shortest path routing extensions is what the LSVR is, whatever that is.
Gotcha. I think Nick Baraglio was helping him out on that project, so I'm assuming once they get a little bit further down the road, Nick will have some updates on it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Our very own Nikki B. All right. You guys ready to move on? Because Carlin had some additional stuff, and I've seen he was talking about camouflaging his like access points and his CPEs out at various areas. He's talking about a really nice upscale area, and he's thinking about going where he's going to install, say, like a CPE on a structure, whether it's a house or like, I don't know, a condo or something like that, and just take a picture of that area, and then going and having like a vinyl wrap printed, and then just wrapping all the CPEs so they sort of disappear, and then maybe like his access points, making like a big 10-foot banner and wrapping it all the way around, I guess, like the sector, so they sort of disappear. And I know I've seen before where people will like disguise their access points and make them look like fake palm trees and stuff like that. But have you guys ever seen anybody vinyl wrap their antennas?
I've seen vinyl stickers with like, you know, company logos or like, you know, for like CPE, like, you know,
right,
property of whatever, you know, design stuff, but like not a wrap.
Right. Not to make it sort of disappear, blend into the background. I think it's actually a pretty brilliant idea. It sounds like a lot of work, but sounds cool.
It I have heard of, you know, painting it to blend. I suppose vinyl wrap allowed to be a little bit more complex as far as what it is versus just going to go buy a brown can of spray paint or whatever. Might be close enough.
Gotcha. I don't know. Maybe the area he's in is a little bit more higher end, a little bit more pinkies up than we're accustomed to.
A bit more sensitive to those things.
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes you got to do what you got to do to get in the door, right?
No.
I'd be curious to see how other people have camouflage equipment. You know, it's not like DirecTV's camouflaging their dishes or anything. Yeah, you know, big giant gray monstrosities on the side of a building. So, I don't know. It is what it is. Let's see. Matt Whiteley was... let me reel back. Carlin was talking about YED software for graphing, for building his diagrams of his networks and stuff, and he was showing how, you know, you can have a bunch of different little pieces in there, and then it's got some kind of auto spacing features in there, so everything will just kind of magically space out really cool, and then you can build a little bit more than have it space again, which I think is pretty cool. I've never tried really anything other than Visio because I'm lazy and I know it, and I can whip stuff up really fast. And then Matt Whiteley was nice enough to send Visio Cafe link, which is just a bunch of free stencils to make your stuff look really pretty. You know, I've seen some people make some really pretty Visio diagrams that they present to customers and stuff like that. And all of mine are very utilitarian and very functional. They are not aesthetically pleasing by any means, but they are extremely functional. So what do you guys generally do if you're going to, I think we've maybe covered this before, but it comes up enough to where I'd be curious to see what you guys use because I can't remember.
I suck at documentation, so I usually don't do it. If I do anything, it's once or twice a year I might draw something up in Visio, but that's about it.
Well, I think in pictures, so if I don't have a diagram, it's extremely hard for me to build stuff. That's just
I've personally been using Wyatt for years now.
Okay.
But not for like network diagrams, mostly for process diagrams or flow charts or logical diagrams. For network diagrams, I usually go to Visio as well.
Gotcha.
But like Wyatt is amazing for complex charts.
Very cool.
Not for diagrams, at least not for me.
You know, I heard somebody say about how expensive Visio was and it just wasn't manageable for them in their price range, which I think is interesting because I purchased my copy of Visio, the license anyway, off of eBay. Apparently there's a system in the UK where you can reclaim licenses and it's legal, you know, if like the machine's being destroyed or something like that. So you can get them for, I think I picked up my Visio license for like $30 or something like that. So it's a pittance. So it's really accessible to anybody who thinks they can't afford Visio. If you want Visio, it's pretty darn cheap.
Also, honestly, for anybody that's not doing this, there is Maps, Microsoft Action Pack, that gives you pretty much everything for like $500 a year. And so for anyone that's not doing Maps, just do yourself a favor and go and do Maps. You will get like 10 licenses of Windows 10, there is 5 licenses of Windows Server, there is licenses of Office and like everything else. All that you need to do, you need to register at Microsoft. There is one like certification thing that you have to do. It's completely online. It will take you like 2 hours to click through it, and yeah, you'll be saving like honestly thousands of dollars a year just by becoming or subscribing for Maps.
Microsoft. if you do anything with Azure, you get like a $100 per month Azure credit from Maps, and Maps only costs like $500 or something like that.
So just
that alone.
It's like each one of our companies, even though we have like multiple DBAs, has a Maps account. So there's interesting ways of getting lots of licenses for those things. Let's see. So moving on, there's the Ubiquiti Unify Flex HD access point that just came out. You guys see that thing? I bet you looked at the link. It looks like an Alexa to me, only much smaller, right? They put it next to, in their graphics, they put it next to one of those little mini Coke cans, kind of the little skinny guys, the skinny boys.
Oh, that's what that was? Yeah, I've been so busy, I haven't really, like I've been catching up on the past week of Slack during the cast.
Yeah. It's pretty cute. It's got 2x2, 2.4 gig radio. It's got a 4x4, 5 gig radio. Wave 2 AC, PoE powered. It says indoor, outdoor, which is interesting.
Indoor, out?
Yeah. It's really cute. They got a desktop mount, wall mount, pole mount, a ceiling mount. Looks pretty neat. And I think you can use it as a slides into their mesh system or whatever. So it can be a mesh AP. And then I was looking at their documentation. They have the Unified Dream Machine Pro. It's kind of hinted in there. And I was like, what the heck is that? And that's like another Alexa-looking dude, right? It's kind of an all-in-one router sort of thing, I think.
Yeah, it looks like they just took like one of their Switch chassis and... I don't know. I think I've posted like an FCC compliance thing for it.
Well, the Dream Pro, I think, looks like a coffee can. But like, you know, like a pretty sleek white one.
Yeah.
That's got like a bunch of radios and some horsepower in there under the hood. So I think it's supposed to be kind of a home router / Wi-Fi thing. I'm not sure if it actually acts as a router or if it's just a Wi-Fi access point. But it's interesting. Another Ubiquiti product, you know. Pop it out in a quarter. Really cute looking little guy.
Yeah, I'm on the newsletter now watching their demo, you know, their animation. I see it, yeah, outside all kinds of stuff. But what's interesting is that, like, they had it sitting on a table in the middle of a room. I'm like, so then how does it get power?
Yeah. Let's see. If I click the buy it now button, they're saying they're about $180 a piece. Which is not inexpensive.
Yeah, that's expensive.
Yeah. Compare that. To
yeah, because
the
AC light is what, like $90, $80, something like that.
Well, I'm holding one of these monster audiences I got from ISP Supplies Disher over there. I still haven't opened the box, mind you, but. This guy retails for about 160-ish, I think, right in that same neighborhood. And he's got a lot more kick than that, though, so it's just
it's
as
a full-feature MicroTik.
Do what now?
And it's a full-featured MicroTik.
It is.
Full-featured set of RouterOS.
And it's got the, I guess, the additional 5 gigahertz radio made for connecting to another one of these audiences or another device somewhere else to kind of bridge it into the network. So it's got more kick and more radios for a little bit less price. Although the I guess the Flex HD is smaller and cuter looking.
It's outdoor.
A little bit bigger. Yeah, and the outdoor or the audience is not outdoor. It's just an indoor AP, so.
Who is the target customer for this? Because it's like they show it in all these like, you know, sexy type applications, but usually business doesn't, you know, like it wants something reasonable, but, you know, but then on the other side, they have their Amplify, which is the, supposed to be the, you know, sexy, chic, you know, in home platform.
Gotcha. Well, maybe.
So where the hell is it supposed to go?
I don't know, man. Maybe this is this going to be targeted more at business as opposed to home users? Although, I don't know, man. It looks from the design, it looks like they would be targeting home users just as well. I mean, I guess the idea of it being kind of a meshing device, so you can throw it in there and it'll automatically mesh and pick up. So it would be really cute for a home user just to pay $180 and drop one in somewhere, and it'll magically connect back to the rest of their network. I guess that's kind of a sexy concept.
But if home's the target, then they have Amplify, which is a home product and has meshing. And it's prettier.
I don't know, man. This thing's pretty cool looking, I guess.
Or is it Ubiquiti ADD, where somebody else got an idea and it was just rushed through without thinking about how it would actually be used?
I have
no idea. They would never do that at Ubiquiti.
like this stupid dream machine that can't... It's a great box, except you can't adapt it to a regular UniFi controller.
Oh, interesting.
It has to be self-contained.
Interesting.
It's like, well... Because it's like... It's a great UniFi box. It has an access point and a switch and all kinds of stuff all in one little box. But you must use the integrated cloud, UniFi controller. Can't use one of yours.
Hmm.
So, like, it's like, well, it's...
That's Ubiquiti for you.
So it's like, well, what are you going to do with that?
It's a standalone device there, huh? Oh, well. Let's all mosey on over to Thomas's security corner, where perhaps we'll get a rant. You never know. So you've got a Cisco ASA denial of service that's new for us.
Yeah, this one actually just recently got promoted to a 9 out of 10 vulnerability.
Yikes.
Yep, and basically it's a DOS, so it's a denial of service, but it's a remote, unauthenticated reload of ASA.
Nice.
So this affects all Cisco ASA. It affects threat defense, firepower threat defense modules, anything running ASA or threat defense code. Basically, just by seeing IKEY, so UDP 500 port open, I can reload the device continuously.
Awesome.
That's a problem.
That's
a problem.
That is a problem. And considering these devices take 5 minutes to start up, at least.
They take a hot minute.
Yeah. And so, I mean, a single packet to reload continuously, right? So you can just scan the internet for open, IKEY, UDP 500, and or just blindly fire packets, one every 5 minutes to every IP, and then you'll find out which one stops responding, and that's a Cisco ASA.
How fantastic.
Definitely I will have a link to the Cisco knowledge board article. Check if your firmware is affected, and if so, upgrade your code.
Gotcha.
On a tangent off of that, you mentioned about how it takes 5 minutes to reboot it. I was at a customer's house today, and he's an IT consultant, works for various companies. He's got my internet and someone else's internet, as anybody running a business should. He was saying that at his house, my internet is known as the good internet, and then the other people is the bad internet, so that's kind of nice. But I digress. He was working on a project that was involving some Palo Alto firewalls, and he was commenting on, he made some change and needed to reboot, and it said it was going to take 45 seconds to reboot. It was more like 10 minutes.
Damn.
I was like, how can a network appliance take 10 minutes? Because once it was, you thought it was done, because it was at a login screen, in the GUI, it still wasn't ready because some other services weren't running yet, so you couldn't actually log in. If you're at the console, it was, it gives you a login prompt and won't let you in. And then just sometime in the future, it now accepts your credentials.
Gotcha. I have no experience with the Palo Altos, but did you say he was doing an upgrade to it?
I don't know what the projects are. I mean, like, that he was doing, but he was saying that this was, like, normal behavior. Like, it would take so, like, you know, 5 minutes plus.
Gotcha. All right, then. Yeah, ASAs take a hot minute to reboot. I mean, there's so many things that I've, you know, you're like 100 miles from a device. You tell it to reload, and then you ping dash T it, and then you just sit there and sweat when it feels like it's taking too long. You know, that's happened to me so many times. Or
a chassis, and it always feels longer you're just waiting for it and staring at the screen.
Forever. Yeah, sometimes you just have to get up and walk away for a second and then come back. Or you haven't rebooted a chassis in 3 years, and you're like, I don't know about this. Let's see what happens. Ugh.
Let's see if we are paying all the soys today or not.
Am I going to have a good day or a bad day? Here we go. Let's roll the dice, boys. Good times.
I too like to live dangerously.
Exactly. I too like to live dangerously.
I guess on a tangent of a tangent, because we never go down that rabbit hole, I was, you know, at that customer today, saw pop up on his Slack, you know, from one of the companies, and he showed me, apparently somebody there got a tattoo of Project Breadwinner, and I'm like, what the heck is this? So, like, I look it up. Apparently, somebody has made a gaming toaster. I don't quite know what it is. I see, like, toast that has, like, green lights on it, and, like, it's...
So, this, it was from Razer, a company that's making, like, gaming peripherals, mice, keyboards, etc., and it was a April Fool's prank, or, you know, publicity stunt for April 1st.
But, like, somebody has gone and gotten a tattoo of it.
Nice.
I was like, what is going on? But then I see a PC Gamer article from May 1st saying that this toaster is actually going to be a real thing. It was April Fool's joke. Now it's going to be a real thing.
There you go.
I was like, what in the...
I could make that happen. I got...
No, I mean, you've got to have your branded, Razer-branded toast, right?
For sure, man.
Wouldn't be a complete gamer breakfast without it.
In a million years ago, in a different life, I made a mini ITX PC into a Lincoln log cabin, and I got in a newspaper. It was pretty awesome.
I'm gonna look for this now, Greg. Yeah, so
I was actually on the front page of the circuit section of the New York Times.
Oh, you made a real newspaper.
Yeah, a real one. That was a long time ago.
March 3rd, 2003.
Yeah, I used to do a lot of modifications. I made a tower and I covered it in AstroTurf, and it was like golf themed, sort of. And I put a golf ball launcher in there, so you would like load a bunch of balls in, and they would like fire out, and then you could like chip into the front of it, and it would like, you know, get it and like shoot it back at you. It was like a little putting thing. I got into a European magazine, but I used to do all kinds of dumb stuff. Oh, back when I was young and dumb and beautiful. I sort of had hair back then, not really though. Let's see. So let's talk about the Windows NTLMN. Domain takeover. What's the story on that, bruh?
Alright, so back to the security corner. Yeah, this one is nasty. So, Windows NTLM is a authentication protocol for Windows that's been deprecated and marked as, you know, obsolete years and years ago and replaced by Kerberos. But surprise, surprise, in Windows 10 and Windows Server 16 and Windows Server 19, it's still a thing. So there is a NTLM authentication protocol vulnerability that allows the attacker to take over the entire domain.
Interesting.
And I'll just give you a second to let that sink in, because that is ridiculous. So simply by having communication to a domain controller, you can take over the entire Active Directory.
Mm-hmm.
How wonderful is that?
That's crazy, because it's the article saying that Kerberos has been the preferred method since Windows 2000. So, I mean, that's a minute ago. But it's still, yeah, NTLM is still enabled by default, I guess.
Yep.
Oh, no.
So, anybody that's running a Windows Server and Active Directory, patch immediately. This should be, like, top priority number one, immediate.
Holy cow.
Rectification.
I'm like, I'm going to a couple of my domain controllers right now. Like, are you updated? I think one is because it just rebooted. I just had to log into it, so.
Imagine how easy this is to exploit. How many kids across various schools will be able to, with a couple of clicks, take over the domain, right? The Active Directory. Imagine how many government organizations, how many businesses. Just this is ridiculous.
Yeah, because it seems to me that, like, a significant amount of businesses, like, until you're at, like, a huge scale, like, the more sophisticated the business, the more likely you are to be disabling updates across your whole network because of, you know, not enough time to, you know, test against all, you know, cases with your software. So I know some places just disable it, which is how they get all these, you know, ransomwares and, you know, various viruses and exploits and things, because they don't update anything.
No, yeah, but it's one thing to get, like, single PCs exploited, right? It's another thing to be able to take over the domain.
The whole domain.
I mean,
well, sure, yeah. Yeah. And so, like, those same people, now it's like, oh, it was just your desktops.
Well, I mean,
now it's your domain.
I mean, if you take over the domain, make yourself domain admin, and then, I mean, you could just exfiltrate absolutely everything, or you could just scrub the entire domain. I mean, you could do anything you wanted.
Yeah, deploy ransomware through GPOs across the network.
Sure, exfiltrate all their information, sell it to China, and then ransomware their machines. Why not do best of both worlds?
So yeah, this is ridiculous. This should be priority number one to patch and fix and immediately remediate against. This is serious.
Yeah, it says even though NTLM relay is an old technique, enterprises cannot completely eliminate the use of the protocol, as it will break many applications. That's awesome. I guess that's like how in the US the metric system became like our standard unit of measurement, but nobody was forced to actually move off of Imperial, so we're all still on Imperial. I guess it's one of those sort of things.
Yet, I had at one of my previous clients, one of their vendors' application required that the user be an admin on the machine for the program to run, because it stored things in, like, the, you know, root C folder, and, like, you can't give permissions in any way to that other than being full admin. And it's just like, there's a holdover from 20 years ago when that wasn't even a consideration, and it's like, how do these companies just not upgrade? Pet.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I don't want to spend any more money on this, so we're going to keep using the same old thing. I've heard it plenty of times. And everybody's got something old out there that they're still supporting, whether they want to or not, for one reason or another.
Yeah. You know, I'm logged into a server 2003 box right now.
Hmm.
For some. Granted, I've only been in charge for about a year and a half, 2 years, and I've been busy with other stuff, but yeah.
Good luck getting patches for that one.
it's like, what can we do here? What's available there?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I had kind of an open-ended thought that I was just curious to see where you guys would go with this. We were doing this exercise at the day job the other day, and I got on the idea of automation thinking, or kind of efficiency thinking, right? So the idea being, this is sort of the birth of it. The idea was, is there a way that we can look at the normal processes and procedures we generally follow for different things and then think of them from kind of an automation perspective and actually streamline it as much as possible? And this goes beyond just network automation or server automation. Case in point, we were talking about, say, we get a call for hands and eyes at a data center, which is really common, right? So somebody will say, hey, call me, go in front of my rack and call me. I'm going to walk you through some stuff, right? So whatever it might be moving a cable from point A to point B. It might be looking at a server. It might be somebody's like lost access to a server, or they think a drive's failed or something like that, and they just need eyes on it, right? So generally what we do is we go up there and we play a game of telephone where we look at it, we, you know, just relay information back and forth, and we're just talking about it. So the idea being, what if you could put like a GoPro on the tech's chest as they stand in front of the cabinet, and that would stream straight back to the customer, right? So they actually see exactly what you're seeing. They can walk you through as you're moving your hands. Right? So it, to me, that's like, that's maybe cutting down a 15-minute interaction down to, say, a minute or 2 minutes, right? It's kind of that automation efficiency thinking. How can I streamline this procedure, right? And that's a human physical interaction. That's not something in a server or something on a piece of equipment. So I thought that was really interesting. But how do you come up with those ideas? I found that if I was already able to come up with these ideas, I would have, right? So it's like, it's just like, you know, how, oh man, I almost went some crazy place with a really funny joke that I would have to edit out. So I'm not going to say that. But, you know, if, you know, why is it that before I go to bed every night, I have to, you know, turn the light switch off and on it three times in every room? You know, if I had somebody come in from the outside and look at that and say, you know what, maybe you need some mental help and you won't have to do that, right? But so the idea I came up with was kind of like an efficiency czar or an automation czar, somebody that would come in from the outside. Maybe they wouldn't even have to be super technical, but just look at things you do on a normal basis and, you know, say, well, maybe you could do this, maybe you could do that. This was sort of born from the idea of, what do you call it, rubber ducky debugging, right? Where maybe you just talk to somebody who's not technical and you walk them through a process you're about to do. You know, like, I'm walking through, this is how I think I should do this thing. And sometimes they can give you insights that you would have never expected. Like, I've come up with some really convoluted ways of accomplishing a task. And when I told it to just a layperson, they were like, well, why don't you just do this simple thing? And the answer is because I wouldn't get to do all these complicated things. And that would be so much simpler and more reliable. Of course, why would I do it that way? You know, and so there's just something about that, having an outside perspective look in at things, that I think it can be so invaluable in kind of automation thinking. I was just curious, if you guys do things, right? So like in the digital world, if you do something more than like five times, you could probably automate it, right? If it's the exact same menial task over and over. Is there something in your physical life, in your physical interaction, your physical business things that you think that maybe you could automate? I was just curious, have you actually looked at that sort of thing? Not necessarily digitally automate it, you know, but like streamline it. Have you ever really kind of contemplated that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, at a real basic level, it's like, you know, when somebody wants to go to this grocery store today, and then that grocery store tomorrow, and then this other store, it's like, why don't you just go to the mall right now and be done with it?
Or like,
it seems like you're hitting at something strange or specific there.
No, I do know multiple people with that issue.
Yeah, so. Or it could be like your support calls. Have you guys ever looked at the support calls you're taking in and seen commonalities in there, and then maybe ways you could, you know, either speed up mean time to repair on that stuff, or you know, maybe come up with a method to avoid getting those calls altogether.
So in Unimus, for example, we do that all of the time, right? Like any functionality or feature in Unimus, any checkbox should be self-explanatory, and if it's not, there should be a question mark or a context help that prevents somebody from either having to go and Google something or create the support ticket or ask things. It's like on that level, speaking from a software development world, we try to engineer the user experience around avoiding issues like that. That's just the software, right? In the real physical world, that gets much complicated.
Well, I mean, in your Unimus world, I see the same thing, right? Unimus going out to devices, say just one aspect of it is going out and backing up devices. If you had to manually do that, that would be ridiculous, right? And then say also the diffing mechanism, right, where it'll take multiple backups and you can compare what's changed, right? There's a physical thing that is a pain in the butt to have to do, and if it was a manual process, people would probably be less inclined to use it. And now you've automated it, and it's super simple, right? And so it's just, you just keep iterating on what's a manual process people are using, or what's something manual they have to do in this, and how do we automate that, right? So it seems very logical to me in software. It's funny how in our real life we don't always think about those sort of things. Like FedEx or UPS decided, that they will calculate routes based on left turns, so the drivers can take, or rather right turns, so they can take as many right turns as possible, because they're probably not going to have to sit at a stoplight and wait for that left turn if they just take a right turn. And so it's interesting solutions to common problems that we're probably nose blind to, like when your gym socks stink really bad and they're sitting next to you for an hour, you don't smell them anymore. They kind of go away, right? And I think we just get callous to those common tasks we have to do all the time, right? The keeping the lights on stuff, the human interaction piece. Maybe it's that I just am super antisocial and I don't want to deal with humans anymore. But it could just be that I'm trying to be efficient. Take your pick which one it is.
Oh, it's like, getting out of the habitual stuff is important. You have to, you just have to, instead of being on autopilot, you have to think about what you are doing, and like constant optimization and constant avoidance of bottlenecks is really important.
Yeah. So what I've decided to do is take somebody who's clever. They don't necessarily have to be technically inclined. They don't necessarily have to be in the same industry. I think it can help. I think it can actually help though. But take somebody who's clever, who likes to problem solve and troubleshoot, and just have them follow along for an hour and see what happens, or look at some common things we do and just have them. So probably in the next week or two, I'm going to give it a go by bringing in kind of an outside guy and just letting him see what we do. The understanding is they'll do it for us and then we'll do it for them, right? So we'll kind of trade annoyances there. But just to see if maybe bringing in an outside perspective actually can make a difference. And I think it will. I'm just curious if anybody else has thought about doing something like that or attempted it on kind of the human level. I mean, you could still use a technological solution to a human problem. I'm just curious if people have sort of, a factory.
Yeah, just replace all the humans.
Yeah, right? With robots. Yeah, as soon as they're thinking, it's like, that kind of killed the automotive industry, didn't it? All the workers there. But I don't know. I think, automation thinking is what I'm going to try and do. And it's I guess it's also efficiency. Like if you ever read the book, Cheaper by the Dozen, the parents in that book were efficiency experts. So they'd go into like a factory and they'd basically say, bring me the laziest guy you got, that you haven't fired because he actually gets his job done. And they would study what he does, because that guy is going to find the fewest number of movements required to accomplish the task, right? And get it done as efficiently as possible. And then they would replicate what he was doing for other people in similar positions throughout the factory. And I just thought, well, that's brilliant. Why don't people do more of that kind of thing? in their day-to-day, you know, because I guess probably most of the people listening here aren't in giant Fortune 500 companies, you know, or Fortune 100 companies, where they're just a tiny little cog in a big giant machine. They're probably, you know, in smaller companies where making a minor shift like this could result in a big efficiency gain for them as a whole. So I was just curious if people actually stop and think about that stuff, or are you so mired down in just keeping the lights on and putting out fires that you don't actually get an opportunity to think about that kind of stuff? So maybe having somebody pop in from the outside would be beneficial. Just curious.
Sounds like something that we should do. I'm too busy trying to fix the technical issues.
You're so busy keeping the lights on, yeah.
And reading about your log cabin PC. And
I think I've got another one on miniitx.com. There's like, yep. I made one for my Aunt Hager one time.
Yep. I was looking at that one too. It's a little wooden box thing. That's interesting.
Yeah, with a big giant CD-ROM drive.
I didn't know anybody that had ever actually bought a Via C3 processor-based system, but that's what your log cabin was.
Yeah, I think I bought one of those, and then MiniITX gave me a couple more to build projects with. The MiniITX peeps. So, there you go. I used to do a lot of dumb stuff back in the day. So, Mikey, Wispapalooza is upon us. You're excited. You're hyped. You're tingling with anticipation.
Yes, and that's a good thing to be tingling with when talking about Vegas. I leave home in less than 12 hours for the airport, and actually Kate's going to join me midweek. So that'll be fun. We've got Tommy man in the cameras,
yeah.
Or camera.
Yeah, T-Sense going to be out there. You're going to be out there. I think JJ and Kim are going to be there this year. I'm not 100% on that, so look for them.
Sure. Yeah, I'm so far behind on like what's going on there, because like I've been so busy with stuff. It's like I'm going. I haven't really like I've booked myself for two vendor like events, but I haven't really done anything else. So probably a poor representation of a Wisp America. Or Wispapalooza attendee. I know we shared a couple articles on social media, Facebook and Twitter, that Visp had made some blog posts last year about, you know, maximizing your experience of the show.
So I saw there's a new Wispapalooza app that people are saying it's got a lot of good info on it, right?
Cause I stopped using the Groupio app that they had before because it was just a pile of crap. It would just randomly close. It wouldn't save. It wouldn't search. It would just randomly not function at a basic level.
Gotcha.
So I just stopped trying.
I think, of fun stuff to go check out, I think ISP Supplies is doing a buy-sells thing, like, you know, like an after-hours thing. Who else is doing an after-hours thing?
I know Sonar, Cambium.
Is Mimosa doing one this year?
I don't know.
I don't think Mimosa is doing much since they have been bought or sold.
I can't say what I know, but I know they're not down and out.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to... Anybody who happens to listen to this tomorrow and needs to sign up for an event, it would be, you said Sonar, Cambium, and then maybe buy sales with ISP Supplies. You can drop by and see those guys about their after-hours stuff. I don't remember anybody else that's doing anything. I haven't been watching it super close because I'm not going, but there you go.
I keep trying to get the vendors to tell us ahead of time so that we can make a Google Calendar and put all of their stuff on there, because people are like, oh, I signed up for such and such event, but I didn't know that XYZ event was happening at the same time. Now I don't know which one to go to, but you know, I've got friends that are going to this one, but I wish they would just tell me all this stuff like 2 months in advance. I just make a calendar and let people just figure out what they want to do.
That would be no fun. Where's your sense of adventure, Mike?
My sense of adventure is nowhere, because I have too much shit to do.
Yeah, me too. All right, guys. We're at an hour and a half. Do you have any final important thoughts?
No.
Did you have any before we started? Didn't think so.
No.
All right, let's stick a fork in it. Mikey, if people want to get a hold of you, hey, maybe next week, where would they do that?
Here's an opportunity for me to say something different than leaving me alone. Next week, I will be in Las Vegas for Wispapalooza 2019 at the Rio Hotel and Casino, the last year at that venue.
Yeah, nice. So go out there, find Mikey, shake his hand, kick him in the junk, whichever you prefer. He's open to anything. He's equal opportunity.
And he's got the tingling, so, you know, he's...
That's right.
He's ready for it.
He's got the fever and needs more cowbell. Thomas, if people want to get a hold of you, how do they go about doing that?
So sadly, not at Wispapalooza this year due to just absolute lack of time. Next year, I promise. But yeah, I'm as usual, just Google for me. I'm very easy to find, and the easiest is unimus.net. Just go there. We have live chat. If you need me, ask for me. I'll be there.
Excellent, excellent. Maybe next year, if you're too busy, you can have a surrogate go out there and do it for you. That way, you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, we are actually on the busy front. We are actually hiring 3 people right now. One of those will be meant to be a dedicated sales guy that go to conferences and stuff like that. So, yeah, next year will be better.
Baller, man. Love those Slovakians, even though I only know one of them. Let's see. If you want to get a hold of me, Greg at GregSoul.com. I occasionally blog at GregSoul.com. If you want to really get a hold of me, the easiest way is to go to patreon.com/brotherswiss. Throw us some love there. Jump on the Slack. Throw a DM. I tell you what, dude, when people ask questions in the Slack or have comments of some sort, I would say within probably 5 minutes, somebody's got an answer, a solution, or a meaningful GIF that will not help you in any way, shape, or form. Case in point, the other day, one of my guys threw a loop in the little local network there. It didn't actually affect anything. It just brought the switch down because he was building up a device and somehow bridged it into the Wi-Fi and then background. Anyway, he sent me a picture of this big fat cat staring at a bowl of Fruit Loops, and it said, "Brother, may I have some loops?" And I've got to use that a couple of times now. So it's the gift that keeps on giving. Well, we're going back to hieroglyphics, right? With the memes and stuff. So I love it. Anyway, thank you.
It's end cats.
Yeah, for sure. Questions, comments, let us know. Jump in the Slack. Again, I love it when you guys are animated in there, or even you lurkers, kind of like me. Appreciate everybody that's in there. Everybody's got something to offer, something to give. Go and see everybody at Wispapalooza, say hi to him, buy Mikey a beer, give him an SFP, he loves those things. And I guess until next time, we'll see you guys.
And before we finish, it's called the GIF, you know, the GIF.
Oh, the developer said, choose the admin, choose GIF. So, I appreciate the GIF.
We're informative facts, it's okay. We're not disappointing, just give us a listen. Because fun
guys
is the mission, I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.